to read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show.
Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel. And before we dive into this week's episode, a quick shout out to the Groovy Cats at Scrivener. Scrivener is the official sponsor of the Bestseller Experiment. Scrivener is the official writing app of the Bestseller Experiment. It's the app that Mr. DeVoe and I use to write our Kindle bestseller, Back to Reality. And I tell you what, I'm using it at the moment. I'm in the edits on my fantasy novel, The End of Magic. And one of the things I'm using it for is I have all my research, all my resources in one document. So there's maps in there. There's character backgrounds, you know, little things like when you're doing an edit and you need to know if someone's eyes are green or blue or whatever you called them. It's all there. It's all in one place, all in one document. And I tell you what, when you're doing an edit, just having that at hand, it makes all the difference. And that's the great thing about Scrivener. It's so adaptable. You can make it do whatever you want it to do, basically. So if you want to try before you buy, you can go over to literatureandlatte.com and you get a 30-day free trial. Or, now listen up, this is the fun bit. If you want to buy it, you can get 20% off. Just tell them that we sent you. Put in the code BESTSELLERXP when prompted, and you, dear listener, we'll get that 20% off. So go to it. On to this week's episode. We have a wonderful guest this week. Someone I've been trying to get on the podcast for quite a long time. Steve Kavanagh is born and raised in Belfast. He studied law, still practices in law, as I discovered during the podcast. Done several high-profile cases in civil rights law. Not least, in 2010, he represented a factory worker who suffered racial abuse in the workplace. Steve won the largest award for damages for race discrimination in Northern Ireland legal history. Steve is one of the good guys. And you'll know that as soon as you listen to this podcast, he's fantastic fun. Now, Steve is why I'm glad we waited, because we've got Steve is an author on the verge of a massive breakthrough. His new book, 13, I won't spoil the hook for you because we talk about it in the interview, but it's one of those hooks that makes you think, I've got to read this. I just have to read this. And he's getting fantastic quotes from people like Mark Billingham, Ian Rankin, Sarah Pimber, Lee Child, Ruth Ware, Claire McIntosh. I mean, it just keeps coming and coming. He's getting TV interest, all sorts of stuff. He's already in the Sunday Times. He was picked out as one of the great summer reads. In The Guardian, Ian Rankin himself picked him out as one of these great summer reads selections. So, you know, this is definitely a book to look out for. And it's we don't just talk about that. We talk about hooks and how he knew that 13 was going to be a bit different, and the very unique way that he let his editor know that it was going to be different. He talks about starting off in screenplays and some less than helpful advice that he got from Francis Ford Coppola. Why it helps to be a fan in the genre that you write in and a member of its community, and how we discover that, frankly, nobody knows anything in this business. So let's jump in and listen to that right now. Steve Kavanagh, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today, sir?
I am very well indeed. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Why take so bloody long? We've been trying to get you on it for ages. But I'm glad I waited, because here we are, just a few days after the publication of your brand new thriller, 13, which I think is going to be a massive breakthrough for you. Everyone's very excited about this book. Tell us about it.
Well, that's great. We're all fingers crossed for it. Yes. 13 is it's the fourth book in the Eddie Flynn series. But like all the books in the series, you can read them in any order. They all work as standalones. But there's a tagline which kind of sells the book for 13. And the tagline is, the serial killer isn't on trial, he's on the jury.
And as soon as I read that, I went, oh, that is such a great hook. Did it just come to you? Or did that land in your lap? Or how did that come about?
That one did. It just kind of landed on me. I thought, you know, what if you had someone who was really manipulative and had a real agenda and was prepared to kill to get onto a jury? for a particular trial. And I thought, that's a good setup, because I like stuff about juries. Juries, that the psychological drama that happens in a jury room is fascinating to all lawyers. So I thought, yeah, I'll do something. Who would be the worst person you could put on a jury? And I thought, yeah, serial killer. That would be the worst person.
Because you have a background in law. You studied law, didn't you?
Yes, I'm still a practicing lawyer. Yeah.
Better watch what I say.
Yeah, no, I'm still a practicing lawyer. I do civil rights law, criminal law. I practice in Northern Ireland, where I'm from. So, I still have the day job.
Let's rewind a bit not book one. Let's go before book one, because when did you start writing?
That's an interesting question. I started off writing screenplays. When I was around 18 or 19, I wrote a couple of screenplays because I didn't think I could write a book. I was always a big reader and a big crime fan, and I liked fantasy stuff as well. But I thought, there's no way I could write 400 pages of a story. It's just impossible. I couldn't do it. So I thought, screenplays only like 90 pages. That's less work. And it's
not, Steve, is it not?
I subsequently learned this, but that seems more achievable. Because I was a big movie fan as well. So I wrote a couple of screenplays, got an agent, but didn't manage to sell anything. I got a very nice rejection letter from Francis Ford Coppola for one of my things. It was a comedy set in Ireland, and he said it wasn't Irish enough. And I thought, what is Francis Ford Coppola in the way about Ireland? So that was very hard work, for really no reward. And I thought, oh, no. To hell with this, I'm stopping this. So I stopped writing it when I was about 20. I didn't write anything then until I was 36, like nothing. At that age, my mum passed away quite suddenly. And she was the only person who ever encouraged me to write. And she had given me the love of reading. She had given me my first crime novels. And I thought, I'm going to have another go at this. I'm going to try and write a book that she would like. So that's how I started writing my first book.
That's fantastic. So you were, 20 years old when you got a rejection from Coppola?
Yeah.
And you had an agent?
And I had an agent. And then I thought, I'm not going to write anything more. It's too hard. I'm not saying I had a great agent. I had an agent. But I thought, no, I'm just not going to do it.
But you jumped back in with thriller fiction. So a lot of authors will tell us they wrote several novels before they got picked up again. How was that experience for you? How many failed novels did you write? Well, I say failed novels. We learn from each one of them, don't we?
Yeah. Here's the thing. The opening pages of the defense of the first fiction I've ever written, almost word for word. So I'm the people that other writers hate. And I do get a lot of my friends are writers, and they say, they swear at me when I say that. But it's true. That's what it was. I wrote like a paragraph of a scene before that, like an action scene, and showed it to my wife. And it was like it was just to see if I could put words on a page and see what I could do with them. And my wife read it and said, that's really crap. So I thought, I'm not going to show her anything else. I'm just going to go away. I'm going to write my story. And I started writing the defense.
Right. And Eddie Flynn, where did he come from?
Eddie Flynn came from a number of different places. He was influenced a lot by Clarence Darrow, who was a famous civil rights lawyer. And Darrow was also a bit of a character. He would bribe juries and do things like that, allegedly. Mm-hmm. He was never prosecuted for any of these things. But he was a real character. And a lot of courtroom tricks. And also I conned a witness into admitting that they were lying, basically, during a trial. I'm a solicitor, but I'm a solicitor advocate, so I've done advanced advocacy training, and I've studied advocates all my career, which a lot of lawyers don't do. A lot of lawyers just say, I go in and I answer my questions, or I ask my questions, and I do my work, and I give my speech, and I go home. But advocacy is a real art, and either you can do it, you can learn to be competent at it. But you can't learn to be anything more than competent, I don't think, unless you have a particular gift for it. Right. And that's what I saw, and I thought that would translate well into a book. Because a lot of the things that happen in a cross-examination have more to do with psychological manipulation and the language. Every word is a weapon and it's used in a particular order for a particular response, and you are controlling everything that person says. And you're leading them down a path that they don't want to go down, or they don't know they're going down in some cases. So that always fascinated me. To see it done well is incredible. And I thought, that's what I want to write about.
And you put all that into your first book. Presumably then you sought out an agent and a publisher. How did that work out?
Yeah, I tried to get an agent. So I wrote The Defence, and then I started off getting an agent. I tried smaller agencies, first of all, because I didn't think it was good enough to try any of the bigger agencies. So I started off small agencies, and they all rejected me almost universally. Then I tried medium-sized agencies, and they all rejected me. And there was one small agency in Northern Ireland, and it's a two-person practice. And I sent off the first three chapters of The Defence, and an email back from one of them saying, oh, this is brilliant, really love this, but I don't do the crime and thriller fiction. It's my partner that does it, so I'll let them read it. I thought, okay. I thought, well, that's good. That's encouraging. But I had been close before. I'd had sort of sniffs before. I thought, oh, no, I'm going to try it. So I sent it off to two of the biggest agencies in the UK, the ones that I really, they were my dream agencies. And I thought, just for the hell of it. And then the smaller agency came back to me. It was a Monday night, and I got an email back from them saying, well, I've read this now. I handle the thriller fiction here, and this book will never be published. Scrap the whole thing and write another book, and I'll represent you. And I thought, oh, my God, that's just – I was devastated. And then on the Wednesday, I had offers of representation from Curtis Brown and A.M. Heath.
Right.
And I went with A.M. Heath, with Ewan Thornycroft, because I talked to him and we really seemed to get on. He really seemed to understand what I was trying to do. And I thought, you know, this is someone who could help me. And he has, and he did. So that was it. It took off from there.
That's a bit of a crossroads in your life, isn't it? You could have jacked it all in. You could have rewritten, and who knows where you would have ended up.
Exactly. Ewan sold a book that was like... five publisher auction here in the UK. There was 11 publishers bidding for it in Germany. So it was just, it was incredible. Mm. And then I also then realized nobody knows anything in this business. Nobody really knows anything for sure. So that also taught me a lesson.
Took me 25 years to learn that one, Steve. The Defence was the first book. Great breakthrough, you know, great debut. We often talk about, you know, first books and breaking through and that kind of thing. We rarely talk about that difficult second book. Now, how you under pressure, you're under contract, you're under pressure to deliver. How was that experience for you?
I took the pressure off myself a bit, because by the time I did a long lead up to The Defence coming out. So the book sold, I think, in October 2013. It wasn't out until early 2015. Obviously, I had to edit it and write it properly. But by the time the first book came out, I already had my second book finished and edited and in the pipe, ready to go.
Excellent.
And it was a follow-on, another Eddie Flynn book. And it was slightly different. You know, it was a different type of book, maybe a bit more mature, and slightly sort of grander themes in it. So I took the pressure off myself by already having it done.
And what had you made a conscious decision to stick with a series character?
Yeah, I always like reading series myself. That's why I love reading Michael Connelly and James Lee Burke, John Connelly, Lee Child. So I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to try and create a character, series character, that readers can follow.
So book two was The Plea.
Yes.
And then we come to book three, The Liar. Now, when you're coming to book three, you're having to come to a series character. You're having to keep them fresh and keep them exciting. How did you go about that with this book?
Well, as a reader, if I'm reading a series, I like reading, if a new Lee Child book comes out, I want it to be the same Lee Child book as the last one, only different.
Right.
So I thought, well, that's what I want to do. So some of the elements of the books are the same to same characters, but they're very different books. So The Defence is kind of like an action thriller in a courtroom. It's Die Hard in a courtroom. The Plea is sort of a locked room mystery with a bit of sort of money laundering in the background. The Liar is more of a straightforward mystery, mm-hmm. I think. On a slightly different pace. And I started the experiment a little bit with The Liar, where I had a different narrative. The first two books are just Eddie Flynn first person. And with The Liar, I brought in a little bit of a third person narrative in it, which was at a different set at a different time, just to see if I could do it. And I learned from doing that. So I took what I learned from that book and brought it in then to book four. And book four is first person with Eddie, and then the third person narration follows the serial killer, Joshua Kane. So I, and then the one of the book I've finished, or I'm about to edit, a standalone, it has five different points of view, all third person. So I'm learning as a writer and hopefully developing and trying to do something different.
That's fascinating. Just giving a different point of view, you can see your protagonist in a completely different light.
Totally, yeah. And it allows you to move around and to see, you know, to see what the bad guys are doing. I always like that in Bond movies where they showed you the bad guy in the hollowed out volcano with a chair and a big white cat. I thought, that's awesome. That's what you want. And obviously I'm not writing that, but, you know, it gives you that sort of flavour of it. It's allows you to balance the story a bit, because every story you need a hero and you need a bad guy, an antagonist and a protagonist. So if you're able to see both of their points of view, I think you get a much more developed, much more rounder story.
Yeah, definitely. I think if your antagonist has a point, you know, maybe has, you can almost side with them, I think it makes them a lot more compelling.
Yeah, that's what I tried to do. I mean, every villain in a book thinks they're the hero. So you want them to have their own goals and their own setbacks as well. So sometimes, and I have had readers, some readers saying, I was almost sort of rooting for the killer at some points. And I thought, oh, that's good. I'm glad you did that.
Yeah.
I really want you to do that, because like it was me trying to do a bit of a homage to Silence of the Lambs. And there are a few tips of the hat to Silence of the Lambs in this book. I've always loved Thomas Harris. And Hannibal Lecter's a brilliant character, because he's a little bit charismatic. You sort of think, I quite like him.
Yeah.
You know, you would sit down and have dinner with him. You'd always be watching your back.
You might
not get home, but you'd have a really lovely time. You know, and there's also a little bit of a moral code with Hannibal to a certain extent. So I did want to have a character who is awful and does terrible things, but is incredibly smart and can almost admire them slightly.
Mm. Which brings us to 13. And this is a book from the very beginning, from the first time we started talking about it in-house. I can tell you, everyone was very excited about it. All the stars had aligned, people were telling us, you know, everyone is absolutely rooting for this to be a smash hit. Did you know this was a different book? Does it feel like a different book to you? Does it feel like a step up or an advancement? Or for you, is it business as usual?
No, this felt like a very different book. And I knew when I'd finished that it was a different book, because I didn't absolutely want to burn it when I finished it. Ian Rankin has a quote on a sticky above his desk. I think it's a quote from Iris Murdoch, which says, every book is the ruin of a perfect idea. Every novel is the ruin of a perfect idea. This book was as close as I could get to the original idea. And for me, it was a success, because I was quite happy in that I'd accomplished what I thought I could do with it. And how good it was is not up to me, but I got what I wanted to do with it, and I think I got that pretty good. So for me, it felt like a success. And my wife read it. My wife reads all my books, and normally when she reads a book of mine, she says, oh, right, sit down. And she goes through a long list of things that I've done that are wrong. And she's brilliant. She's a great first editor. I couldn't do without her. She's fantastic. But with this one, she read it and went, yeah, you spelled something wrong on that page, but other than that, yeah, you're good. So I was like, oh yeah, that's great. And I actually sent it in to my editor, Francesca. I got a box. I printed the whole thing out, put red ribbon around it, filled a box with $1 bills, which were folded into the shape of butterflies, and sent it, had it delivered to my editor that way. So because I wanted everyone to look at this and think, okay, what is this? This is something different. So I was trying to kickstart that, because I felt it was something different.
That is either a genius idea or the act of a psychopath. It could have been misinterpreted. That could have really backfired.
Yeah, I did warn her. I have to say, it didn't just show up. I did warn her. And she seemed to really like it. Yeah. So that's one of the things in the book, is there is a lot of this book is about the $1 bill. because it's a fascinating thing. I like, if there's anything I do in books, there is something, a little bit of an area of just sort of general knowledge almost. I like to look at that and tell people what is really going on about it. And these are everyday things. Like one of the things Eddie does in the books is, like if you watch CSI or any of these programs about forensic science, and there's lots of books written about forensic science and how brilliant it is, and we've got the guy's DNA from an apple and now we've got him, we've nailed him. And I'm thinking, no, you haven't. Yeah. Not at all. And so one of the things Eddie does in the book is I have him torture a different expert at one stage in the book about so-called forensic science, because some of it is forensic science and some of it is theory. And there's a big movement now in the scientific community about experts and stuff like this. So, in 13, I tried to take a little bit. So the $1 bill is a fascinating object. Mm-hmm. And there's whole theories and about it that like there's a picture on the $1 bill. It's the Masonic symbol. But it was there before the Masons were formed. But there's loads of conspiracy theories about it. But even not looking at that, even looking at different things around us, there's so much that's interesting and fascinating about that single note. So I wanted someone to have as much fascination with that note in an unhealthy way as I do. That was it.
Brilliant stuff. Did you see, I mean, certainly in-house as well, there's been... because we felt it was a step up, we felt it was an incredible book, there's been a step up in sort of the marketing and the publicity and stuff like that. Did you sense that when you got a response from Orion about that?
I did, yeah. And Ewan and I came in and met Orion and we talked about this, and everyone championed the book from very early on, and Francesca and Emma have been fantastic in pushing it through. John Wood as well, here, he's always been a big champion of mine. Mm-hmm. So it's been really great to see, and that seems to have built out and spread. And a lot of the authors that I know, we sent the book out to them early for quotes, and they all came back, every single one of them, and they all said, "Well, yeah, this is a step up, but we do like this." So, and that's awesome. That's brilliant for me. So Lee Child was the first person to get back and say, "Yeah," and then Michael Connolly, and yeah. Just went on and on from there, and Claire McIntosh and Sarah Pinfrey. So it was fantastic. It's great when someone you admire reads your book and says, "Oh yeah, I really like that too." There's no greater feeling than that. It'd be nice to sell a few copies as well, make a few quid. But that's also, it's nice. Also nice to have the respect of your peers.
Well, let's. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the crime community and your place in it, because we have something in common, which is we've both interviewed Michael Connolly. Yeah. I did it in the back of a car for sort of 20 minutes, and I was, oh, that's brilliant. I've interviewed Michael Connolly. You did it on stage. I've seen the pictures of you on stage, and you were completely fanboying. It was one of the greatest moments of your life, I think. Do you want to? And I think predominantly you're a fan, aren't you, first and foremost?
I'm a huge fan of his for years. And so I never thought I would get to meet him, never mind, interview him on stage. We had a really good time, We both of us did. So we talked about his book, which I was, talked about that in detail, talked about the series and Bosch coming to the small screen. And we had a real laugh. We really enjoyed it. And he took a selfie with us on stage afterwards, which is still my screensaver. So, yeah, we've had a great time. And I've been lucky as well. I do a podcast as well. Myself and Luca Vesti, we do a podcast called Two Crime Winners and a Microphone.
Never heard of it, never.
Never heard of it. So we've been able to interview different authors. So we've had Ian Rankin help us launch the podcast. We've had Lee Child on, and
we haven't had either of those. Keep rubbing it in. Go.
So you'll get them. It's great. We like talking to crime writers because, and actually we're talking about this on Radio 4 the other day, and we're talking about the show. A crime writer is like a bingo cage full of brilliant stories. That's what a crime writer's head's like. So you just have to give him a nudge and one will rattle out. And so it's quite an easy job that we do. And, unlike the bestseller experiment, we don't know anything. Luca and I know nothing. So it's we're just doing this for entertainment, to have a laugh. And when we're talking to crime writers, we're not proper interviewers, really. So we're just talking to them about, well, what books do you like? And we're talking, it can go anywhere. It's the way we wanted to do it was we wanted to have to be the conversation we would have with them anyway, in a bar at midnight at a convention. And that's what we do. I'm trying to do every week.
Yeah. But I think what's important there is you have become part of that crime writing community. And I think whatever genre a writer writes in, I think if they are going to succeed and if they are going to get reviews from their peers, they need to be a part of that community. Were you aware of that when you started out? Did you say, you know, I have to get to know these people. I have to, you know, meet them. And you know, in the first instance, you're a fan, but also you're also a published writer, incredible writer. Was that at the forefront of your mind when you go into convention?
No, I just wanted to meet them. I was just a big fan and I just wanted to meet them all. And then I got to know some of them and we become friends. So, but it was never a conscious decision in any stage. I think looking back on it now, Angela McMahon, who used to do publicity for Orion and for me, would occasionally give me a pint of beer and point me in someone's direction or put me down next to someone. And we would just talk and we would get on famously. But I only sort of thought back and looked on that in hindsight and said, what was Angela doing there? She's really sneaky doing that. So, but it was never a conscious thing for me. I just get on with people and I love talking to people.
But it must be difficult if Angela wasn't there, would you dare walk up to another crime writer and start, particularly one who's maybe had a few hits? That's a really, most writers are quite shy people, you know. It's quite a difficult crossover to thresh, isn't it?
It can be. I've never been shy, I have to say. That's not one thing you can accuse me of. And I'm very lucky in that I got to know some really good writers very early on. So I got to know Stuart Neville early on and Mark Billingham. And those guys are brilliant, fantastic writers, but you know, they are kind of my mates too. Mm-hmm. So they were brilliant in introducing me to people and doing things like that. But it was never a conscious thing. It was just, we're here and we're doing this thing. We're going to go and get something to eat. We'll have a pint and we'll have a chat and we'll have a talk. So, but I really like their company and I love hearing their stories. And so it's, to me, it's a social thing. I think if you have it in your head, I need to go and meet people because I need to get into this community and have, you know, and be marketed, you're doing it the wrong way.
They'll see it coming.
They'll see it coming and they'll go, what the hell are you doing? Right. You know? Yeah. But I think if you're a crime writer, you're probably not going to have that in your head. You're just, you know, there's a few people I've seen doing that, I have to say. And we all know who they are. But, you know, it just be yourself. Because that's what everyone wants. Just be yourself. Yeah. And, you know, if you can tell a joke and buy a drink, you'll get on famously.
Yes, buying a drink is the easy part, really.
That's the easy part. But that's all you need. If you can buy a drink, you can have a chat with a crime writer.
I don't drink alcohol, right? I'm teetotal. I remember going with Ian Rankin to the Oxford Bar with him and John Wood. And they had a pint. He had a pint. I'll have a Coke, please. The look I got from the bartender...
I've been in the Oxford Bar too. Yeah, there's certain bars you go in and you ask for that. You might have been all right with an iron brew, believe it or not.
I'll remember that for next time, right?
Next time, get an iron brew. I think a poor fella's had a heavy night. He's just taking it easy for one there. Leave him alone, he'll be all right.
The top tip, thank you. What is next for you now? I mean, you've got this whirlwind week of publicity, I guess, ahead of you. Is that next on the agenda?
Yeah, I'm doing a few events around the country. Myself and Mark Billingham and Martin Waits are doing a few events. So that'll be great. And after that, it's back to work, back editing.
You mentioned book five. Where are you with that?
Yes, book five is called Twisted, and it's a standalone.
No Eddie Flynn
this time.
Oh, how's that been?
It's been really fun. It's been scary. It has been scary. I wanted to do something totally different. So it's kind of an old school psychological thriller in the Ross McDonald type of vein.
Brilliant. Sounds fantastic. But will Eddie Flynn return, or is that a spoiler for 13?
Eddie Flynn's coming back. Just having a little break, trying something different. Because I felt I was at the stage where if I did another Eddie Flynn, it may not have been so good. I thought, I'm going to have a break. I'm going to see if I can do something else. And it's still in the same, with the same vein, and it's kind of still me. So the pages turn quickly. There's lots of twists. There's pretty decent characters. It's a bit funny and a bit dark and a bit twisty. And I thought, well, if I can do that in an, you know, so where it's not someone standing up in court, it's a different type of book. So, yeah, so it's about the world's greatest mystery author, J.T. LeBeau. In this book, J.T. LeBeau is one of the big authors in the world, sold millions of copies, and no one knows who he is. He's never been seen. It's a pen name. So that's the background of the book. And the book, it'll have my name on the cover. It'll say Twisted. And when you open it up, it will say Twisted by J.T. LeBeau. So you're reading a J.T. LeBeau book. That's how it's written. And the book is about a lady called Maria Cooper. And Maria is in a quite an unhappy marriage with her husband, Paul. She's seeing someone else and she's sort of thinking she's made a mistake and dreaming of a better life. And it's at that stage she discovers her husband has $20 million in a bank account and her husband is probably J.T. LeBeau. So, of course, she decides the only decent thing to do is to kill him.
I love that. That is fantastic. Well, look. 13, I really hope 13 is the smash hit that it deserves to be. And read, listeners, if you read that, you've got three other Eddie Flynn books to get into before the next book from Steve. Steve, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been a real joy and best of luck and hope to speak to you again soon.
Oh, yes. No, thank you very much. I listen every week. I love the show. So it's a real honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben. Take care. Well, huge thanks to Steve for taking the time to speak to me. It was a really fun interview. I could have spoken to him all day, actually. And yes, he does have a podcast, a rival podcast to ours, Two Crime Writers and a Microphone, which I'm not going to plug. I'm not going to plug it, Steve. Sorry. Where he and Luca Vesti managed to talk to all the crime writers that we failed to get on our podcast. So no, I'm not going to plug it. Sorry, mate. Two Crime Writers and a Microphone. Okay. So yes, 13, like I said, has all the hallmarks of that big breakthrough novel. And it does take me back to what happened with Ian Rankin and Black and Blue. You know, Ian had fairly modest sales, but Black and Blue was that big breakthrough for him and the character of Rebus. So I've got everything crossed for Steve that 13 turns out to be that big breakthrough thriller of the summer. Thanks to everyone who's got in touch on social media. We love hearing from you guys. We had a lovely tweet from Simon A. Brett, who is at Simon Brett on Twitter. Said, listening to the bestseller experiment isn't all about writing, you know. Thanks to them, by the end of today, I've watched 3 episodes of Breaking Bad, finally, and set up my personal Ko-fi, and he did a bit of writing too. So congrats, Simon. You win today. Good stuff. We had a lovely bit of feedback from Little Miss Contrary on Twitter, who is at Eamon Monroe, that's E-I-M-A-N Monroe, M-U-N-R-O. She'd been listening to our live show highlights with Amber Cadaveo, in which we talked about everything to do with children's writing and publishing. She said, I love this. I cleared a 4-hour this morning to cheer myself up knowing it was Amber sharing her encyclopedic knowledge of children's publishing. Filled with such a buzz now, I've been searching for quality podcasts too and I found it in the bestseller experiment. Well, thank you very much, Little Miss Contrary. Really hope you enjoy it. We've been included in a lot of kind of podcast roundups recently, which is fantastic. We had one from Susan Earlham, who is at Susan Earlham. I rounded up 10 of my favorite podcasts around the themes of creativity, writing books, and being online. So thank you so much, Susan, for including us in that. And also, this is the great one. This is just the best news ever. And we seem to be getting one of these a week now. This is unreal. Lorna Cook got in touch. She was at Lorna Cook Author. She sent us a tweet saying, bestseller XP, I'm attributing much of this to your fab podcast and frankly, flipping fantastic author interviews. Well, Lorna has just signed a 2-book deal with Avon Books in the UK. This is just brilliant. Brilliant news. We are so happy for you, Lorna. And it's what we love to hear. So the debut, The Forgotten Village, will hopefully be coming in 2019. And there's a second book as yet untitled. So this is just brilliant news. So everyone, it's at Lorna Cook Author. Please send her your congratulations. And Lorna, thanks so much for letting us know about your success. If you want to get in touch with us, you'll find us on Facebook at Bestseller Experiment. Twitter and Instagram is at Bestseller XP. We're on Pinterest too. If you've got, you know, a cover that you want to put on our art by cover art by our listeners page, then let us know about it. And don't forget to buy our book, Back to Reality. Perfect for summer reading. You know, if you want to escape, want a bit of, they're calling it uplit now. This is what I think, we're definitely in the uplit genre. It's proper feel-good fiction. So yeah, Back to Reality. Check it out on Kindle. Hopefully paperback soon. We'll keep you posted on that. So thanks for listening, everyone. We really love hearing from you. We hope you love the interview, and there's some more great stuff to come soon. So subscribe, rate and review on iTunes. And until next time, happy writing.